This is Attack of the 20th Century. Thank you for joining us as we explore science fiction, fantasy, and horror films of the 20th century. I'm your host, Jeff. And I'm joined by my fellow hosts, Kim and Mike.
Hey, guys.
Here's to swimming with bow-legged women. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to episode 47, where we conclude our summer swim series with the 1975 film Jaws. Look for us on Instagram and Facebook at Attack of the 20th Century. That's 20th. We post our next movie selection there. You can comment, give your thoughts, and they just might make it on the air. We always like to start with, what have we been watching lately?
So there was a series that I think it came out maybe about 10 years ago, True Detective. It was during the reconnaissance,
yeah,
right? When Matthew McConaughey was coming back. And so we had never seen any of them. That, I think it's like Fargo, where it's, you know, different stories for each season. But I was kind of intrigued by the fact that Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson were on the same season.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was during his rise to stardom again. And so wanted to try it out. And so far, we're only about four episodes in, but it is... It's a very good, very good show. Excellent acting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm enjoying it quite a bit.
Awesome. Well, the Hanshaws have been watching a sitcom, basically, with the kids. Chuck. So it's got Zachary Levi before he becomes Shazam, and he has accidentally downloaded into his brain all of this secret information from the NSA and the CIA and the FBI. And if he sees certain things, it like triggers his memory. And so he's got, you know, the hot, is she an FBI? CIA agent. I never remember which agency they work for. Is she FBI? So he's got the hot chick that's got to look after him and take care of him. And then he's got like the beefcake guy that's got to, they have to protect the asset because he has all this secret information.
They call the Intersect.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do they call him? The Intersect. So anyhow, he gets into all these like spy type antics and it's fun. It's cute. There's a little romance going on, which our 11-year-old likes to be like, oh, grossed out about. But it's been pretty fun to watch.
So is Zachary Levi, is he like the same comedic tone that he had in?
No, he's more of a, like a Jim of Jim and Pam from The Office, I would say. Like just kind of a likable down to earth. He's not as snarky, but I don't know. He's a little Shazam-like, wouldn't you agree?
He's a little bit like Shazam, I would say. He's kind of this, because he kind of acts like a kid.
Yeah.
Kind of naive to the world. And he's like 30. Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess so.
Pretty sure.
Because he got kicked out of Stanford.
Yeah.
So sometime post-college. And he's really underachieving because you figure a Stanford type student probably shouldn't be working at a place like Best Buy and their Geek
Yeah, what's
squad.
It called? It's called Buy More or something.
Like Buy More. I think it's great because it's kind of every teenage boy's fantasy, you know, that you're kind of living a normal life and then adventure finds you, right?
Yeah.
You get caught up in espionage and there's a beautiful spy that's kind of looking out for you and you're falling in love with her. And so to me, it's like, it's an exciting kind of wholesome show, I would say.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. We've had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah. True Detective is definitely not a wholesome show.
For the record, not on the same page.
it's got a lot of good comedy.
Okay.
No, it doesn't.
No comedy.
Just kidding. No. Very dark.
All right, what are we reviewing this week?
Okay, we are wrapping up the summer swim with the ultimate summer swim movie, which is Jaws from 1975.
Woo-hoo.
So here's your spoiler alert. We are going to talk spoilers. So if you haven't seen Jaws from 1975, hit pause, go watch it. You won't regret it. Come back and join us later.
That's right.
And I know the Rotten Tomato scores.
Let's hear them.
So the tomato meter gives it a 97%, which I highly agree with. And the audience score is a 90%, which I think we expect that to be a bit higher. Yeah?
Yeah. So I wonder what that means. Like 3% of the critics thought this is a bad movie? Like, yeah. I wonder what 97% means.
That's a good question.
I'm more concerned with the fact that 10% of the audience didn't like it.
Yeah.
Are those just people that really don't like sharks?
Yeah.
They're anti-fishermen, maybe.
What were you thinking was going to happen in this movie?
Is it the PETA crowd? They're like...
That's it.
Yeah. You can't harm even a killer fish. I mean.
All right. Let's go through what this movie's all about. So the film opens with a young drunken couple breaking away from a party to go for a swim. While her suitor falls asleep on the beach, a girl is brutally murdered in the water by a shark. And I have to say, like watching it again last night.
Who does that?
Yeah, first of all, who does that? The second of all, like it is brutal. The word brutal.
Yes.
There's no music and she is getting violently murdered.
Yep.
It is horrific. Because I've seen things like people say, is this movie really horror? I was like, watch this. This is horror.
Yep.
We're introduced to Martin Brody, who is the new police chief at the sleepy town called Amity Island. The mayor quickly establishes that he's against closing the beaches because the town needs the income from summer tourists. We get a classic scene of the chief on the beach, anxiously watching the waters, seeing an old man swim up under a large woman floating, a girl screaming before having her partner hoist her up in the air on his shoulders. We see a man playing fetch with a dog, and suddenly the dog just disappears. We see a guy talking to the chief, blocking his point of view, before we get a POV shot of the shark seeing legs dangling in the water until it comes up on a boy who's on a raft. And then the water turns blood red. That we have that famous camera zoom on the chief, and we have that murdering of the Kittner boy on the raft.
Terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. The town posts the reward for the one who kills the shark, and they close the beach. We meet Quint, a local fisherman who offers to do the job for a substantial raise. We also meet Hooper, a marine biologist who has been requested to help the authorities through this situation. The money posted gathers this huge crowd of fishermen, and lo and behold, they catch and kill a shark. Hooper's not convinced that this is the right shark, so he and the chief go gut the shark. They do a little autopsy and discover they've killed the wrong shark. So still yet, the mayor just kind of turns a blind eye to everything and says, no, do whatever you got to do to keep the beaches safe, but we will be open for July 4th. This is our big moneymaker.
I mean, he's concerned about his community. He wants people to make money.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you got to make the tough call, right? Yeah. When you're the big cheese, you got to make the tough call. Sadly, the mayor was wrong. Another shark attack happens that day. Amity Island has officially become Shark City. Quint is hired to lead a shark hunting expedition. So this really the kind of the final third of the movie now takes place on the water with Chief Brody and Hooper kind of as his first and second mates. The team encounters the shark multiple times. They shoot three barrels into the shark to try to track the animal and keep him from submerging too deeply. The men bond at night with this famous scene where they compare like various scars. And we hear Quint give a monologue that he was on the USS Indianapolis, the one that delivered the atom bomb.
Amazing scene.
Yeah. And they were subject to an unsightly number of shark attacks. Their discussion is cut short when Jaws shows up, our shark, and starts punching holes into their boat. And at this point, you know, the sun starts coming up, the boat starts sinking.
Yep.
So they decide, hey, let's put Hooper in this shark cage that he brought. And he has one of these hypodermic needles at the end of a pole. And he's going to try to stick it into the mouth of the shark. That doesn't go so well. The cage is violently ripped apart, but Hooper escapes. We don't really know that at the time, though. So as the boat sinks, the shark gets a hold of Quint in a bloody fashion, and very similar to the very beginning of the movie, this is a horrific scene. There's no music. It's just a violent munching on this guy, Quint, who we've grown to love. The chief is able to stuff his pressurized scuba tank into the shark's mouth. As the last part of the boat is going under, and as the shark is approaching, and we have that epic music playing, the chief successfully fires a bullet into the tank, exploding the animal. Then Hooper reappears. The chief and Hooper swim back to the shore, and the credits roll.
There you go.
All right. Now, when did we first see this film, and what was our first impression?
I don't know when I first saw this film, because it's such, like, just a part of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I saw it at a very young age, because I knew about it. I mean, we live in Florida. I bring that up, I think, every episode. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But sharks are a thing that exists. We go to the beach, you know, and it just kind of kicked off my fascination with sharks, even as a young kid. And it was almost like if it's summertime, you watch Jaws. And then eventually, is it the Discovery Channel? They caught on to that, right? The Discovery Channel's like, oh, yeah, people watch Jaws. We should do like Shark Week every summer,
yeah.
Right? And it became like a whole thing.
Yeah.
So
now there's so many programs like The Meg versus Jaws.
Oh, yeah.
Who would win, Jaws or an octopus?
I think Shark Week was cool when it started. But yeah, the last time we tried to watch it, it was like, okay, I don't want to see The Meg and a T-Rex like animatronic go at, whatever. It was kind of dumb. But yeah, Jaws has just been there in my movie watching past forever.
Yeah. 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 My story is a lot like yours. I just remember growing up with this movie. I don't remember the first time I saw it, actually. I will say we had Jaws 3 on VHS, and I watched that one a lot more than this first Jaws movie, and it's just part of my childhood, that giant shark. But I can't remember when I first saw it, but I do love Jaws. I grew up loving Jaws. I've seen it, I don't know, 20 times on VHS or DVD or streaming. And I even got to see it at Tampa Theater. They played it, and the place was packed. It was like one of those summer specials where they had playing old movies. And it was so exciting to see Jaws with a packed movie theater, because everybody had seen the movie already, and they were all reacting to every scene. And when Chief Brody says, you're going to need a bigger boat, you know, that line, whenever he says that line, the whole place erupted in clapping.
That's awesome.
It was really cool.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Yeah,
That sounds amazing.
And then we watched it with our kids. And you and I were talking about it. We were at a thing at school, and my kid, who was just a tiny, tiny kid at the time, he's asked what his favorite movie is, and he tells everybody it's Jaws. And what did your son say?
You've seen Jaws? What? Yeah. Then so, I felt guilty. I hadn't shown him Jaws yet because my son was older.
I felt a little condemned, like, oh, man, I'm the bad parent. We let our kid watch Jaws.
Yeah.
But what about you? Now, what's your history with the movie?
So I'm like you. I actually don't know when the first time I saw it. It was just kind of there. I think it was on TV a lot, or I don't really know. But I know I grew up loving it. You know, it wasn't until later where I kept on watching it. And I think at first, as a kid, you know, you're there for the blood, you know.
Yeah.
You want to see people get eaten by the shark.
Mm-hmm.
But as you grow older and you start, you know, listening to the, you know, the dialogue and things like that, you start to really like the movie for different reasons. And, I mean, talking about our kids, what a fun movie this was to relive with my kids.
Yeah.
That's the fun of being, you know, a dad, you know, of
right.
just reliving the things that you loved, you know, in your youth.
Yeah.
And there's a couple movies that I would put on that list. Mm-hmm. And I mean, between, you know, Star Wars and Indiana Jones, this is definitely, I'd say, one of the top three.
Yeah.
So, super fun. And, it's got a very big place in my heart.
That's awesome. Yeah, if you look at pretty much any top 10 horror movie list, it's always in the top 10. If you just the top 50 movies of all time, it's always in there. A lot of times it's in the top 10 also. So I think it's universally loved.
Yeah, I mean, this movie is one of those ones that has really like transcended what it was meant to be, which was, you know, a popcorn horror flick.
Yeah.
And it is now considered one of the best movies, one of the most well-directed movies of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the amazing stuff that come out of this movie is just, it's an amazing formula of how music and photography and directing and acting should all mix together.
Yeah.
And it made one magical piece of cinema.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, now we always talk about standouts and setbacks. So obviously we've already claimed that we're fans of this film. And I think we have more standouts than setbacks in this movie.
Definitely.
The first standout I want to mention is the use of music. The score by John Williams. And I think this is what catapulted John Williams into the international eye, right? Like, he is really one of the most regarded movie composers of all time.
By far.
And this is the one that really catapulted his career. And wow. I think, too, so we have the epic score, and I don't want to downplay that. That theme song, like, even if you haven't seen Jaws, I do remember this. I had never seen Jaws, but I saw the movie Mr. Mom.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And there's a scene where the vacuum cleaner goes astray.
Yeah.
And it plays that Jaws music. It does something like that.
I've heard people talk about how it is so part of our vernacular now, or just what we know.
Yeah.
That you'll find little kids singing that, you know, when they're playing in the bathtub or something. I mean, it's like, it is just part of who we are as people now.
Yeah.
And that is pretty impressive to be a composer and have that much influence on the public.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You're right. I think when you picture someone being stalked, like something creeping up unbeknownst to the victim, this is the theme. And it came from this movie, obviously. Somebody swimming, having a good time at the beach, summer vacation, July 4th weekend or whatever. You're splashing around, you're having a good old time, and little do you know, you're about to be lunch.
Yep. Yeah, and it's interesting because I don't know if there has been another instance where a composer, and correct me if I'm wrong, where they have taken the music and taken it to the point where it's part of the movie, in the sense that, like, he even took the, you know, it was almost like Pavlov's dog, where we were programmed to know that when we heard that music, the shark was nearby.
Yeah.
And that's how they even used that in a scare towards the end, because when Hooper was in the cage, there was no music to tell us that the shark was coming for him.
Yeah. You're right. The music fades away as the shark swims off.
Yeah.
And we're thinking, like, okay, where'd he go? And then you have that jump scare where the shark just shows up.
Yeah. I mean, you think of movies like Psycho, you know, that's a famous score. Who is that? Leonard? Bernard Herrmann.
That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, with that movie, it fits the movie.
Yeah.
But it doesn't play tricks with your mind like John Williams' score does. And that's what makes it just so brilliant.
And of course, that's the main theme of the shark. There's other pieces that are really epic. One of the things I love most is after the shark's defeated and they're swimming back, with Hooper and the chief, there's this real just peaceful, like, kind of summer, spring, the skies have opened up and it's a time of peace.
Something else I liked is, and I didn't notice it, actually, I was listening to the score on the way over here.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, and he intertwines the little song that Quint sings, you know, Spanish Ladies.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got that in the score, too.
Does he?
So it's kind of neat. Like, I wonder, was it originally meant to be in the movie, and he, you know, added it, or, you know, had it in there before it was in the movie, or did he add that later?
Right.
I'm guessing probably later, but I don't know.
Yeah. You know, and I mentioned this before when I was telling about what happens in this film. There's a couple scenes where there is just no music. And I think that's super effective, too. The murder of the girl in the beginning, and then when Quint is being murdered, there's no music. And you're just hearing splashing, you're hearing the person screaming bloody murder, it's very uncomfortable, a very discomforting scene, both of those.
Yep.
It's like, wow, less is more. And then they chose which moments to use the music, the pulsating, pumping music of the theme.
Yep.
And when to just have no music, you're just going to hear somebody be killed.
Yep. So, you know, my daughter actually is going to she was accepted to a kind of a high school film school. She had to apply and everything.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And she's just in the first couple of days here, but I asked her to ask her teacher what, in his opinion, you know, coming from a film teacher, made Jaws great. And he said two things. One was the music, and the other was the camera work. And that is, I mean, that's pretty much what I, to me, was a standout. Because I feel like they both went hand in hand.
Yeah.
You've got the amazing score of John Williams, but then you've got the amazing directing of Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you see it in every single shot in this movie, practically. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it just such a masterclass of filmmaking and cinema. Everything from the way he positions characters in some of the long shots that he did, showing power or frustration amongst the characters. One of the scenes that I actually was listening to a film analysis on it, where during the Indianapolis scene, he specifically positioned Quint and Hooper far apart from each other in that scene to just kind of symbolize how far apart they were as far as their relationship. But then as they're talking about their scars, they get closer and closer together until they're centered in the frame.
Wow.
There's things like that. Then, you know, his genius use of the dolly zoom shot, you know, from Vertigo that Alfred Hitchcock originally did. And, you know, you could say, well, he was copying, but I don't think so. I think he used an amazing technique at the absolute best time, because that scene, your stomach literally drops when you're watching Brody, you know, see the attack that is occurring.
Yeah.
Just genius.
Yeah.
And even in that scene, how, you know, as people cut in front of the camera, it cuts to a different viewpoint or a different scene as he's trying to watch. And it just adds to the tension of everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right. Because you're getting annoyed. You know something's going to happen. You feel like something's going to happen. He's trying to watch what's happening out there. And he has two different guys come up. There's one guy that's talking to him about, hey, can you do this? We're having problems with this or that. And you can just, like, even how this guy's talking, none of us are listening to what he's saying, and we're all irritated. Dude, get out of the way.
Yeah.
We're trying to look to see if a shark's going to show up.
Yep.
And then the old guy comes up. Remember that? And he's just kind of like
talking about his house, having issues with his house or
something. Yeah, yeah. Well, no, the second guy, I think, comes up, the old guy, and he's like, oh, we know about you, Chief. You don't like the water. it kind of rubs it in his face a little bit.
That's an ugly hat there. I can't remember what his name was, but yeah, Chief Brody was pretty quick with a comeback.
Pretty annoyed, and we're annoyed. Yeah. And I think Spielberg is one of the best people to just work you emotionally, just like Hitchcock was.
And let's not forget the biggest thing of all, right? Which is the fact that the shark was not working.
Yeah.
And he wanted to focus the first half of the movie on what the shark's point of view was.
Yeah.
Which added to the tension. It, you know, let's be honest. I mean, the shark scenes, you know, are good, and they did a good job with the technology they had. But there are points when the shark actually shows itself where you're like, oh, that's a, you know, that's very robotic movements or whatnot. So he was smart because he helped develop the tension by not showing the shark. He helped us get more intertwined into loving his characters.
Yes.
Right? And so it became a movie where, yes, the shark is the big focus of the movie, but the characters, you know, are really what drive the movie, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's my next standout, Mike. The the investment of time in the characters. So the character development, they have all these, it's a horror film, but they have all these tender moments. And I'm just thinking of that table scene where Chief Brody's been slapped in the face. He's drinking. He's at home with his family. He's just got the blues. And unbeknownst to him, his son is mimicking his every movement. And that little boy is just the cutest little guy, right?
Yes.
And the mom comes in and she's watching it. It's just such a tender moment. And it takes a little while for Chief Brody to realize his son's mimicking him. And then he comes in and like makes a snarling face and goes in and he says something like, give daddy a kiss. Why?
Yeah.
Because I need it.
Yep.
And it's such a small, tender moment. But when Chief Brody is on that boat later on and they're hunting that shark and he's in peril, like, this is a guy we care about now.
Yes.
This isn't a disposable character. This is, you know, that little kid's dad.
Yeah.
And that woman's husband. And like, he's got to get home safe.
And what a roller coaster for this guy, right?
Yeah.
He was bullied into, you know, into doing what he didn't want to do from people that were more powerful than him.
Yeah.
And he was the one who got blamed.
Yeah.
Right? And then, you know, that scene, it was almost like a healing moment for him in a way, right?
Right.
And then it wasn't until his own son was in danger where you really see things like kick up. And he, at that point, is out for revenge. He wants to get the fish.
Yeah, he does. Enough that he'll go out on the water, even though he's deathly afraid.
Deathly afraid, yeah. And the fear is definitely, that is a point that is made very evident all throughout the movie.
Yes.
So.
Another scene, he and his wife, early on, this is another point where he's a little bummed about how things have gone. It's been a rough day. And his wife's with him, and she says something like, "Want to get drunk and fool around?" And this is a guy that's got a couple kids. It kind of reminded me of Poltergeist, another Spielberg film, between that couple.
They're human.
And they're human, yeah. And it was just, it was fun to see them interact that way.
You know, another scene that made me feel that way was when, you know, he's telling his son to get off the boat.
Yeah.
Get off the boat. And, you know, she's like, "Why are you saying that? You know, they're fine. They're fine." And she looks down and sees the image of the shark punching through the boat, which is foreshadowing, of course.
Yes.
She's like, "Get off the boat. Didn't you hear your dad?" You know, it's like so true to life, right?
I mean, it's I love just, that scene too.
Yeah.
Wow. That was great.
So the other two characters that I feel like were really well-developed were Hooper and Quint.
Yes, definitely.
And, you know, Quint had less screen time than Hooper did.
Mm-hmm.
But they created one of the most iconic characters of, you know, of cinema history. I mean, everything from his first introduction, scraping his fingernails on the
chalkboard.
Which, funny enough, actually, he was originally, I believe they actually shot it, or it was supposed to be shot. He was supposed to be in a movie theater laughing at
Moby Dick. I saw that, yeah.
And he was supposed to like empty the theater out from just laughing at this portrayal of a man hunting a fish.
Yeah.
And, you know, they didn't get the rights, but that would have been a great introduction as well.
Sure.
But, you know, from the scraping on the chalkboard, which, by the way, I mean, is it pretty clear that he's the one that drew the picture on the chalkboard?
Yeah. It was pretty decent artistic skills as well.
And so, you know, that's his start. And then, you know, he, you can tell this man at the, you know, in the beginning, he only cares about money.
Right.
And he's abrasive. And, you know, the whole scene in the dock where he's like, you know, making Hooper tie the knot. You can tell this guy has some real problems with the people around him.
Right.
And he doesn't like someone who's richer than him. Doesn't want anybody on his boat.
Yeah.
But you know.
Even tells the chief, remember, if you're on my boat, like, I'm the captain.
Yep. But then his character arc, you know, as after his, you know, barrel fails and they're on that boat and they start comparing scars, you know, it's kind of a character, I guess, all three characters converge and they find a common source of connection.
Yes.
And except for Brody, actually, he even though he was interested, I got the sense that he was a little outside that conversation. It was kind of Hooper and Quint.
Yeah.
But like you notice, like Brody, you know, he when they were comparing scars, he lifts up his shirt and sees an appendix scar.
Yeah.
That's a lot different than getting scars from fish and, you know, broken hearts from.
Well, I think first of all, Brody was really out of his element.
Yeah.
He had never been on the water. He didn't want to get near the water. And even Brody is yelled at a few times by Hooper. And I think Richard Dreyfuss does such a good job in his role. Like, even though he yells at Brody probably three or four times, we don't hate Hooper.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some ways, like, you're attacking our guy, the guy that we're really following, the principal, you know, head lead actor here. And you've yelled at him three or four times, but we still love you. That's really amazing they were able to pull that off. And I think Dreyfuss had a big part of that.
Yeah.
The way he did it, it was more of just like, he's a guy that lashes out when something happens that he doesn't like. And he lashes out at him a few times. And then I think that story arc that you were talking about, the two guys who are too far apart suddenly, or not suddenly, but over time become close, very close, is really, really fun to watch. And it's evident, if you remember when they're loading Hooper's materials on the boat, Quint looks at that shark cage and he's like, you know, like, you go in the water, the cage goes in the water, shark's in the water, and he starts singing farewell, to your fair Spanish ladies.
Yeah.
But guess what? When that boat has a hole in it, he's like, so you really think you could get a needle into this shark?
Yep.
Hooper, why don't we let you do your thing now?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that second half of that movie was just on the water, and it was this versus that, right?
Yeah.
You had the old technology versus the new technology.
Mm-hmm.
And Hooper's telling him, give it up. Why are you using a line? You know, you know, he doesn't have a shark on the line. And, you know, and then Quint is, of course, telling him, well, you know, what would have cut this piano wire, you know?
Right.
And then once Quint's way of doing things fails.
Yeah.
He gives up and lets the young guy have a chance.
Yeah.
But I think that wouldn't have happened if they hadn't had the bonding moment that they had that night.
That's true. That's true.
I think that he finally found kind of connection with Hooper and gave him a shot.
Yes.
And I mean, of course, the boat was sinking, and of course, they were running out of options. So why not?
It's an act of desperation, also.
But if I might just point out one thing, no one give Hooper anything in the water that's important. Just don't give it to him.
Oh, yeah.
Because the guy drops literally everything.
The shark's tooth.
Shark's tooth, the harpoon with the poison.
Yeah.
Like, come on, man. Hold on to it tightly. He should have learned from the tooth, right? No, but, you know, the other thing I really like about Hooper is, I mean, the comedic aspects that he brings to the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Hilarious. You know, when he's fighting against Quint, or Quint is making comments about him, and he's like, you know, making faces at him, or, sure. I can't take much more of this. I can't remember what movie that was from or what cartoon it was from. Much more of this abuse.
Yeah.
Hilarious. And, you know, there's the aspect that he just was kind of an oddball, right?
Yeah.
It was odd for him to come to dinner And, you know, he brings the two bottles of wine, but he notices that Brody hasn't eaten his food. He's like, do you mind if I eat that? You know, and he just grabs his plate and starts chowing down.
Yeah, he scarves it down.
It's just odd behavior, but,
yeah,
you know, I guess that just made the character richer.
Yeah, yeah. There's one other scene I wanted to mention. Roy Schneider, you know, Chief Brody. Remember they had that false alarm where they emptied the water, and it turned out to be a couple of kids with a hoax. They had a cardboard fin. And then over in the lagoon area, that's where the shark's really coming into.
Yep.
And this lady starts screaming, shark, shark. And he's like, oh boy, what is it now?
He
says something like that.
Yeah.
And you can just tell he's disgusted, defeated, beat down. And his wife says something like, our son's over there in that lagoon.
Yep.
And his head's down, and he just starts walking. And the music moves with his steps and his motions. And he goes, just within like an 8-second period, from being like, what is this crap?
Yeah.
This is nothing. To he gets faster, 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 and until he's frantically running, like, you know, this might be a real thing. I need to take it seriously. And sure enough.
It was a real thing.
It was a real thing. And something else you'd said about the filming, if you remember when they're pulling their son out of the water, where our view is obstructed, and they're pulling the boy, and you're really expecting his legs to be bit off. Do you remember that scene I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
They're dragging him onto the beach, and there's somebody blocking our view, and when they pull him, and at the last second you see he's got both legs.
Yeah.
But just things like that, that camera work.
Oh, another great use of camera work where you see the camera just buzz by the son's face, right?
Yeah.
And it just... You could tell the look on his face and the way that the camera moved, that shark had come really close to him.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So,
which made you think that he lost his legs.
Yeah.
One other thing that I found really interesting in recent news was one of the boys in that shark or with the fin, he was elected the chief of police for the town that was filmed in.
Are you serious?
Totally serious. It was the kid that the other one pointed at and said, he made me do it. That kid grew up and he was elected chief of police of that town in Martha's Vineyard.
Are you serious?
So cool, right?
I saw something else, and this is one of those IMDb trivia things, so they may or may not be accurate, but the lady that played Mrs. Kintner, she went into a restaurant and they had something, a menu item, that was called the Kintner. And so she told them, hey, you know, I actually played the mom of this boy in the film. And they said, are you serious? The boy that was in the movie is actually back here. Like, this is his restaurant.
Oh, that's cool.
So he came out and they had a little reunion.
That's awesome.
I thought that was pretty fun. Hopefully it's true. Who knows, right?
I'm sure it is. Everything on the internet's true.
I think so. Abraham Lincoln said that, I think. Trust everything on the internet. One more standout I wanted to mention was this film has a perfect mix of horror and levity. And you may know more about this because you saw this documentary about Jaws, right? The making of Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd read where the director, Steven Spielberg, said when he first read the novel, he found himself rooting for the shark because all the humans were despicable. They were so unlikable. And it was his insistence that, hey, let's take out some of these subplots. Like in the book, they had like a mafia theme going on. There was like a Hooper and the chief's wife had a an affair. And
which, by the way, I love this movie so much. I decided, you know what?
Yeah,
I'm going to listen to the book.
Oh, did you?
I listen to audiobooks as I'm driving around. I'm in my car all the time for work.
Yeah.
And so I got the audiobook and I'm like, oh, yeah, this is it's a little different, but it's good. It's good. Yeah. What the heck is going on here? What is going on? Hooper, stop it. Stop it, Hooper.
Yeah. Yeah. You care too much about the chief and his wife and his family?
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing, Hooper?
It was weird. It was very strange. And it's very graphic, too.
Like, is it?
It's really graphic. I was like, I see why it was cut out of the movie, because it's...
Yeah. I mean, while we're on that, Peter Benchley wrote the book. He wrote it the year before.
Yep.
I think he took his first hand at writing the screenplay, but it went through multiple revisions. At some point, he was asked to leave the filming because he got unruly. You know, things went a way different direction than what he thought it should. But he does have an appearance in this movie, and we'll talk about this in Setbacks. Yep. I'll save that for Setbacks.
Yeah, yeah.
But this idea of levity that Spielberg introduced, you know, just think of the scenes that, I don't know, that lighten the mood a little bit. And Spielberg said, I don't want this just to be a dark shark hunt. And one thing I'm thinking of, we reviewed Orca maybe a month ago, Kim and I did, and it's kind of a dark shark hunt. I'm using quotes because it's a killer whale. But it's kind of a dark film. There's no levity. It's just all serious business. And not saying anything about, you know, is this always the right way to go? Or is that a bad way to go? Or is this a good way to go? I'm not saying anything about that. But this film in particular wouldn't be the same if it didn't have some of that, those moments of silliness or happiness or levity, right?
Yep. Yeah, you know, we were talking about Hooper earlier and how, you know, he's cracking jokes throughout the whole movie. He is a large part of that levity, right?
Yes.
But there's also the dock scene, the two old guys that, you know, stole their wife's, you know, roast to go hunting. And
they want that reward, buddy.
Yeah, they wanted the money. Imagine how many roasts $3,000 can get you. You know, it's just comical until it got a little scary.
Yeah.
You thought he was gonna, you know, bite it, but yeah. I mean, he really kind of intermingled some of that levity throughout the whole movie, and it made it real, right? Because I mean, unless you're like on the set of Saving Private Ryan and it's just all dark war, right? Real life is intermingled darkness and levity.
Yeah. And another moment where the levity happens, of course, they're comparing scars. And you remember Hooper, he uncovers his chest and he says, right here. And he says, so-and-so, she broke my heart. When he starts laughing and they're all laughing together, like you can't help but to laugh too.
Yeah. Well, it's also just a moment that you're seeing these two guys on opposite sides of things.
Mm-hmm.
They're finally bonding. Like they've found something to kind of connect with. And, you know, it's a scene that kind of like touches you in a way because these two guys hated each other.
Right.
And they found a common you know, aspect of things.
Yeah.
And it was, it was super funny. And then it got really serious, right?
Yeah. And you're right. And I think sometimes you need those moments of, I care about these guys. This is fun. And then he goes into this whole story about the USS Indianapolis. And he goes through this just horrible imagery of what he endured, not for hours, not just for a few days, but it was like
over a week.
A week. And very impactful. Of course, if you read online, it says, well, Jaws overstated what happened and this or that. The sharks were more than content eating the dead people. They didn't need to go eat living people. But still, like this is in cinema.
Yeah.
It was an amazing scene. And just thinking through what he described, it would be hell on earth.
I honestly, it's one of the best scenes in all of cinema history. Just the progression from going from comparing those scars.
Yeah.
And the acting in it is just amazing. Like, I mean, obviously, Robert Shaw.
Yeah.
Robert Shaw. Was amazing. Like, it's the pinnacle of his career, you know, from everything else I've seen him in. But Dreyfuss did an amazing job too. Right? Mm-hmm. He's laughing, and then he mentions Indianapolis, and boom, it stops.
Yeah. Well, there's even a moment where he asks, what's that there? Oh, it was a tattoo I had removed. And Hooper says, like, let me guess, it said mother. He wants the laughs to continue.
Yeah.
And you can see this light smile on Quint's face, but this isn't a thing to laugh at, you know?
Yeah.
And he goes and tells us why, and pulls us into that story.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, and I hope I'm not taking us off topic here, but I just, you know, with the sequels to Jaws and how they weren't nearly as good as the first one.
Right.
By far, right? Mm-hmm. The one I can say I kind of enjoy was maybe Jaws 2. Uh-huh. And then the rest are pretty bad.
Yeah.
But when originally Steven Spielberg had an idea for the sequel, which was actually not a sequel, it was a prequel.
Really?
And it was actually that Quint being in the ocean with his war buddies. Oh. Can you imagine what that movie would have been like?
Yeah.
With the direction of Steven Spielberg?
Yeah. Wow. I would love to see that.
I still want to see it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm talking to you, Steven.
Yeah. You listen to this podcast, I'm sure.
Jeff and Mike are telling you. We want to see that movie.
Go film this Joker.
I mean, honestly, that could be like the comeback of the shark movie.
You yeah.
Know? So just real quick, going back to the Indianapolis, though, that scene. Mm-hmm. What amazes me is Quint's performance, though.
Yeah.
And how nuanced the way he tells that story. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, he actually kind of wrote that scene himself.
Wow.
So it went through a couple renditions, but he, you know, shortened it and took the, I guess, the parts that he liked.
Yeah.
And originally he wanted to do it drunk. And so he came in, he was pretty toasted.
Uh-huh.
And they couldn't do it.
Oh, no.
And so, he asked Steven, I guess, the next morning if he could come back in, and he was completely sober, which he had definitely an alcohol problem during the filming of the movie, but even more so after. Mm-hmm. But he did it completely sober and pulled it off completely.
Yeah.
So
you're right. You know, we have a segment here where we talk about our favorite scene. I don't know if we even need to do that today, because I think both of us, that scene we're talking about right now has to be one of the best scenes ever in cinema.
Completely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to think of another scene. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only other scene I can think of would be in the same movie, and that is of the beach scene, where just the amazing direction of Steven Spielberg in that scene.
Yeah.
And editing too. You got to, I can't remember the lady's name who did the editing, but just fantastic film work.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Awesome. We went through a lot of standouts, and there's probably a lot more that we haven't covered, but just in the interest of time, we'll keep rolling. I think this segment will be shorter, our setbacks. And I'll get us started. There's not a lot.
Oh, I got a lot.
Oh, no. You're one of the 3% of critics that hate this movie.
No, I'm just kidding.
The only thing that stood out to me is we have amazing acting by our lead actors, but some of the ancillary characters, the acting we have is a little bit weak sometimes. And there's two in particular that stood out to me. And I didn't even know who this was at the time, but there's a news anchor talking, and he was just so flat, no life in him. And I remember thinking, like, why would they pick this guy to do this one little bit role? You know, he sucks. And then I went and looked. That's actually Peter Benchley, the author of the Jaws book.
It is kind of cool, though, that it's him, you know?
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't the greatest, but...
But the other actor that I thought, man, he was flat, the boy at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, he's chasing the girl, and he's like, oh, you know, I'm not drunk. I don't know what he was saying. But then when he was talking to Brody the next morning, just his dialogue was flat. I mean, he just seemed like kind of an idiot. And I guess you could say, well, you know, he was a dumb kid, right, doing dumb things, and he's hungover. But he just seemed flat. So that's my one nitpick is some of the background characters, they're not nearly as good as the foreground characters.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I've been thinking about this. I'm trying to figure out what I agree with some of the smaller acting roles, but it's really hard for me to pick out something that I did not like in the movie.
Yeah. And yeah, this film is a true classic. There was some criticism about the mechanical shark.
Oh, yeah.
What did you think about the mechanical shark? And I guess they called him Bruce, named after Spielberg's lawyer.
Yes. Yeah, so if this entire movie had been filmed with that mechanical shark, mm-hmm. it would not be a classic. In fact, it might even have been, you know, considered just campy.
Yeah, right.
But amazingly, it was not. Now, I guess that's the only thing I can say is maybe some of the scenes, the shark looked mechanical.
Yeah.
But like, you know, even like Back to the Future 2, right? Mm-hmm. That scene of Marty, you know, and the holographic shark, you know, coming, he still like screams,
yeah.
gets eaten by that shark, and then yeah. says, the shark still looks fake.
Yeah.
Right? And that's true to the movie, is that we get scared by it, or, yeah. you know, it was scary. But then, you know, later we're like, oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, he had mechanical movements. But you know what? When you're in the movie, it fits.
Even my daughter, she's watching it and is like, that shark looks real. Like, and there was several scenes where the shark just appears out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And scares the crap out of you. And it does look real. There's only one scene I can think of when I thought, that shark doesn't look so good. It's when the shark is mostly out of the water and yeah. he's leaning against the back of the boat. The boat's starting to yeah. sink at this point.
Yeah.
It was like too much of the shark in broad daylight. Like, that's the only scene that I would say, he doesn't look all that great.
Yeah.
The rest of the scenes don't bother me.
But you got to have scenes like, you know, that, yeah. that was that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that movie without that scene, right?
Yeah.
Quint sliding down. Yeah. How cool is it too that the machete that he was going to use to cut the fishing line, he, mm-hmm. you know, put into the side of the boat. And then, you know, as he's sliding down, he grabbed that machete and he's stabbing Jaws yeah. as he's being eaten alive.
Yeah.
Perfect ending to that character.
Yeah.
He's trying to kill the fish as he's being killed.
Yeah. On his way out.
Yep.
He's trying to take that shark with him. So yeah, these are nitpicky things. This has to be one of the best films end to end that I can think of.
So I completely agree. And mm-hmm. it deserves every aspect of things. Was it even nominated for an Oscar?
Oh, I do have some of that. So it was nominated for Best Picture, and it lost to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I mean, that's a very good movie.
Yeah.
I don't think it was quite up
yeah.
to par with Jaws. Yeah.
It was a great film. I think they should have reversed it. Like, this film should have won.
Mm-hmm.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is a great, excellent film. I think that movie did great in the Oscars that year. It swept several of the major categories. But this one did win in 1976 for Best Sound, Best Film Editing. Verna Fields, I think you were looking for her
yes,
name earlier.
Yes, yes.
And then Best Music, Original Dramatic Score, John Williams.
Well, that's totally deserved.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm glad to hear it won some awards, because it definitely deserved it.
Now, some of the other cast members... how did you think Lorraine Gary did as Ellen Brody?
Perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Completely believable. I mean, she had, you know, not as many scenes as the main three.
Mm-hmm.
But she did good. You know, it was yeah. it was heartfelt, you know, when she's watching Brody with his son.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I think I mentioned it earlier, that scene was actually ad-libbed, or it was brought back in, because during the outtakes, after the camera was off, Brody and the kid were messing around.
Uh-huh.
So they were really doing that.
Uh-huh.
And Spielberg saw it and he's like, we have to do this in the movie.
Yeah.
So pretty cool little addition.
Yeah. It was just simply magical, right? I think she milked every scene she was in. I thought she did great.
Yeah.
She wasn't in it a lot, like you said, but even when she's saying goodbye to her husband, and you have this awful boat captain is like yelling at him, hurry up, chief, we got to go.
Mm-hmm.
and he starts doing these weird limericks or something.
Yeah.
Just, I could see her perspective. This is an awful man my husband's about to go out with and entrusting his life with.
Yeah.
This might be the last time I ever see him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was completely 100% invested in that scene. It's like, I could see how she would feel this way.
Yep.
And then she turns and runs and cries. And yeah. And I already mentioned a couple other scenes. She wasn't in that many more scenes. I think I mentioned like three different scenes. So yeah, she did great, I thought.
The mayor.
Yes, the mayor.
He did an amazing job. You know, in a way, you understand where he's coming from, right? This town, it survives on the summer.
Yeah, tourism.
So he's trying to keep this town alive. And he was, you know, had this terrible situation where he's having to try and manage that.
Yeah.
In the end, he's pretty slimy, right?
Yeah.
He's choosing business over human life.
Right.
But I don't know if you caught it, but he actually is driving around in a realty car. So he actually has an invested business in the town, which makes him even more slimy.
Yeah.
That
whole scene where Hooper's trying to convince him, we got to close the beach. And the guy's like, oh, so they told him the story where they found the tooth, you know, and how big it was. He's like, oh, but you lost the tooth, huh?
Yeah. Finding excuses.
Yeah. So what did you think about his story arc? Because remember at the end, he does actually sign off to hire Quint and do this expedition, but it was a little bit too late.
Oh, yeah. The slimiest thing he said to me was when he's standing in front of Brody, whose son almost just got mauled to death.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, my son was on that beach too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like no one would compare the two situations. Like one was in the water, got, you know, brushed by the shark.
Yeah.
The other one was just present, you know?
Yeah.
And,
that's true.
He kind of sealed the deal on him being a slimy dude and he had to sign that paper no matter what.
Yeah.
So
one of the favorite scenes I have is when the Miss Kintner slaps Chief Brody after she had, and then she proceeded to give him this whole, you knew, yet you kept the beaches open. You let people swim. My boy's now dead and there's nothing you can do about it. I just want you to know that. And that mayor is standing right next to Chief Brody and doesn't say a word.
Not a word.
Until she's out of earshot.
Yep.
And then he says something like, I'm sorry. She's
it's not
wrong.
Your fault. Yeah.
Yeah. She's wrong.
And Brody, of course, being the hero,
yeah,
takes on that mantle of guilt.
Yeah.
I read that take took 17 times. She had to slap him 17 times.
Oh, that's awful.
That's where acting is not so fun.
Yeah. Oh my. All right, now's the time in which we say yay or nay, and what say ye, Mike?
I would definitely say this movie is a nay. I mean, I've talked about it all the... I'm just kidding. Yeah, this is one of my top three favorite films of all time.
Wow.
Anyone that has not seen this movie, you are doing yourself a terrible disservice. It's really good, and it's a standard that should be followed with movies going in the future. So,
yeah. Yeah. I agree. It's definitely a yay for me. It's one of those magical movies where everything just goes right. There's not a lot of those movies out there in the world in existence, but like literally everything just falls into place perfectly. You're swept up emotionally, you're invested in the characters, everything, you're just all in, all three acts. There's not a moment when you're just like, all right, you could fast forward past this 15 minutes. Nope. You need to see every minute of this film.
Even though it was made in 1975, mm-hmm. and it's got that 75 feel to it,
mm-hmm.
it's not old.
Yeah.
It's fresh every time you watch it.
Yeah.
Except for the mayor's suits. Those are pretty old. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Now, I did read that they were considering Charlton Heston as Chief Brody.
Which...
What do you think this movie would have been like with old Chuck Heston as Chief Brody?
You know, I think he would have done a good job. Because he did a good job in everything he was in.
Yeah.
Maybe a little overacting.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I think Steven Spielberg was wise in what he said is that, you know, if Charlton Heston is in this movie, everyone's going to know the shark is going to lose. Charlton Heston wins in every single thing he's in. Mm-hmm. And so let's get someone a little bit more everyday man.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like Schneider brings a little bit of, I hate to say, let's use the word meekness. Because he is afraid of the water. And again, that was something that Spielberg introduced. You know, this guy is afraid of water and he's on an island.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a vulnerability to Schneider, him playing this character, that I don't think you would have had with Charlton Heston.
No. Can you imagine Charlton Heston being afraid of the water?
No.
That just doesn't
seem... No.
Yeah. So everything from the casting to the music to the directing, just a perfect ensemble that made practically a perfect film.
So, Kim, I know you had to step away for a few moments, but we have you back.
Here I am.
And there's something I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
And it's probably the same question several filmmakers have asked themselves. Why can't other movies replicate the success of Jaws?
Oof.
We have done this summer swim series, and I'll talk a little bit to give you a chance to think about it.
Thanks.
We've done the summer swim series. We've done some excellent films. Mm-hmm. And they've all had elements of Jaws, even Creature from the Black Lagoon, which predates Jaws.
Right.
There were elements of this film in all the movies we've done.
Yep.
And you even look at Jaws, the series itself, they had other films, and none of them could recapture the magic that this first film had.
True.
Now, I personally love Jaws 3, but I understand that's a moment in time for me. I had a VHS tape, and I got to watch it over and over again.
Right. Is that the one with SeaWorld?
Yeah, Jaws at SeaWorld. So the question is, how come this film is so superior to so many other films, which seem to be, you know, somewhat similar formula?
Right.
A beast that's gone crazy, killing machine, you have characters that you like. There's a love story maybe in some of them, and some of you don't have that. Mm-hmm. But why is this one so special compared to other animal attack movies, or even specifically the summer swim type attack movies?
That's a great question, Jeff. I just felt like I needed, like, I was going to roll into some very intellectual monologue on movies. Here's my very unintellectual, non-intellectual, I don't know. Yep, it's definitely that take on that. Spielberg, I mean, this is Spielberg, and he's kind of I don't know if he's at the height of his powers with Jaws, but he's definitely like getting near the top.
Right.
So I don't know. He made a deal with the devil? I don't know. I'm kidding. But I mean, you know, he's really good at capturing the human story, even when he's writing about a monster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think what we have here that we definitely didn't have, or not as much of, in the Alligator movie and in Orca and in Creature is just the human story bit there. Like there's fleshed out characters that are well-rounded and they have real human relationships. So there's, you know, you've got just enough backstory for Chief Brody and his wife having moved away from his cop job. Where was he? New York, I think, before.
Something like that, yeah.
Big city, scary job. And he's moved to this quiet seaside town, of course, terror has kind of followed him there. And the whole family element, they're worried for their kids. And you've got this tension with the mayor who doesn't want to lose out on their big tourist season.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it's a small town. So, they're probably very dependent on that income.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, you've got, what's his face, his character?
Hooper?
Yeah, Hooper. He's the... wait, is Hooper the fisherman? Or
the scientist.
Yeah. Okay, so Hooper's Dreyfus's character, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got the science guy, which you kind of had those, they tried to put those elements in Orca, for example.
Uh-huh.
But the character, it was too much. It was like they tried to do too much with it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was too on the nose, I think. Mm-hmm. The writing was just poor. So I don't know. He kind of has the perfect mix of the human element, the story, the well-rounded characters, and then he's got this monster, and it's a real, there's nothing cheesy about it. Like,
yeah.
Like it's a real, it's a seaside town and a realistic, it's not the Meg. It is right. A big great white, you know,
right.
Like there is some enormity to it that makes it like even scarier, but mm-hmm. not to the point of you're like,
I don't really believe this story.
Right. It's believable. It could happen. Yeah, and then, of course, the musical score is fantastic. I think it just didn't miss. Like, every area that it could have excelled in, it did. You know, musical score, storytelling, human element, the monster was believable. And the comedy was right for the moment. It wasn't mm-hmm. cheesy. Like, it was just situational. Not like situational comedy like we think of, but it fit in the situations that were in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, if you were to find something funny in the moment of being terrified of this, being terrified of the water, if you're Chief Brody, and being terrified of this monster and being afraid for your kids' lives and whatever else. But then, yet they're still like, we're silly humans and funny things happen, you know.
Right.
Nothing was forced or over the top. It was a perfect storm. I don't know.
Yeah. I tend to agree with you that it was lightning in a bottle. Like everything happened all together, all at once. And I'm reminded of Lord of the Rings, which I know is one of your favorite movies. And that original trilogy, now they tried to replicate that with the Hobbit trilogy, which was far inferior, right? Mm-hmm. And then we even had I forget the name of the TV show we watched that was also Lord of the Rings show.
Was it Ring of Power or something like that?
Something like that on Amazon.
Yeah.
Again, it couldn't replicate the magic from that first trilogy.
Right.
But it doesn't keep them from trying over and over again.
Yeah.
They would like to make some money.
Yeah.
And there's still something intriguing about it. I know when we saw the Meg previews, it was a pretty good trailer.
Right.
And we still have this fear of Jaws, and we still go to the ocean, and we swim, and we do have in the back of our mind, there are sharks out here.
Yeah.
So when you see this trailer, there's something compelling about it. Like, I think I want to go see this movie.
Mm-hmm.
We saw it just the other night for the first time. We ended up not going to the theater to see it, but we did see it on HBO Max. It has elements, again, of this movie, Jaws.
It wasn't horrible. Yeah.
It wasn't horrible, but it just wasn't anywhere near the quality of film.
Yep.
And they even tried to add in some of the humanistic elements.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy with his ex-wife that he's trying to save.
Right.
But they didn't try to rekindle the relationship like they did like in Die Hard, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, he had a new relationship that he was working on. And there was the, you know, the guy, the scientist guy, or I don't know what he was, but I think he was a doctor. That's right. That thought he was crazy. And they were trying to play into some of that past, you know, angst. And
right.
Maybe a little bit of revenge. And I don't know. It didn't do much for me. Like, it didn't really tug at my heartstrings. Really, I was in it just to see some of the kills. And
that's not what Jaws were they going to do with this ginormous beast, right? And how did they even conjure up this ginormous beast? Because he's extinct, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do think the Meg brings in kind of a sci-fi element because there's so much high-tech gear. That's one thing that I love about Jaws. It's very raw. Like, and it's very earthy, even though it's oceany, not earthy. But it's real fishermen, and they're using the real things that they would use. Like, it's not NASA going in to disturb, you know, unknown creatures in the undiscovered depths of the ocean or whatever. And it wasn't NASA in the Meg either, but I don't know what the oceanic version of NASA is. NOAA? I don't know. But, yeah, so I like Now, I'm sure all the sci-fi people out there are angry with me now, but I like the realness of a movie like Jaws versus like The Meg, which dabbles more in the sci-fi area of things. I'm just, it's not my, it's not my gig.
You have the suspension of disbelief, and this movie just stretches it a smidge. Whereas The Meg kind of goes like, you really have to, oh, there's this some barrier between us and a even further depths of the ocean.
Right.
And, there's prehistoric monsters. Now we've let them out. So it's fun. It's fun, but there's more suspension of disbelief. Whereas in Jaws, like you said, as we have real people with real jobs that we know, you know, with real technologies that they have before them. And a lot of them are primitive. And now they have to face something that probably is bigger than any shark we've seen before.
Sure.
But still.
But it could exist.
It could exist.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do. I think I like that. Yeah. It's less of the sci-fi fantasy. And I'm a fan of fantasy. But, you know, I don't know. The monster movie is. Like, if it's we're talking about a natural monster, you know, something from nature.
Uh-huh.
It just. I don't know. It hits different. It's more believable.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned Spielberg. I think something that we talk about the magic, kind of his unrivaled magic.
Right.
This is the first movie where he has really established himself as an amazing filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And listen to this run here. So that was Jaws. He follows it up with Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, wow.
Huge blockbuster. Then a bust in 1941, which, you know, everyone's got to have a bust every now and then.
Sure.
Raiders of the Lost Ark was the next one.
Oh, gosh.
Then E.T.
Yeah.
Then Poltergeist. And then I could go on and on. But that just that little run there from 1975 to 1982, he has several films that are all in the top 100 films.
Right. I mean, he's really at the height of his powers.
Yeah. Yeah. And we heard Mike talking earlier that Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Wars, and Jaws are his three favorite films.
Uh-huh.
And that's two of them right there that Spielberg did. So just an incredible run for him. And he had a sensibility, and you talked about it, those tender moments between characters, kind of setting up some sympathy for these characters.
Mm-hmm.
So before we put them in peril, we gain an attachment to them.
Yeah.
And he did that better than anybody that I know.
Yeah, even Cranky Quint. Everybody loves Quint from Jaws.
Yeah.
Because you get to, like, he's this rough, hardened guy, but then you find out there's a reason behind that.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to, basically, he has to go out the way he goes out to finish that story arc.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I don't know, Spielberg is pretty unrivaled when it comes to getting the human story right. At least in that window of movies he was doing.
Yep. Very true. This wraps up our Summer Swim series. It has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Something different. Of course, now we're approaching spooky season with Halloween coming up.
That's true.
So our next four films will all be a little more on the spooky nature.
Okay.
So what are we watching for the next episode?
All right. The next episode, we will be watching a Soviet Union era movie called, I think it's called V. It's spelled V-I-Y. And it's from 1967. And we think it's about a group of seminary students that are like on summer holiday, wandering around, maybe drunkenly in the countryside, where they stumble upon an old farmhouse and a haggard old lady that lets them, you know, basically stay the night there. But then they find out she's a witch. One of them murders the witch. Maybe she wasn't really a witch, and then they have to wait with the body for 3 days to protect it from evil spirits, and I think a whole bunch of other crazy stuff is supposed to occur. That's really all I know about this movie.
Neither of us have seen it, and this is a film, of course, that's completely different than Jaws. Jaws had international success and was the top grossing film of all time until Star Wars came along.
Right.
And V, probably your friends don't know about this movie.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah. It is available. The whole movie's on YouTube.
Oh, okay.
And if you have a subscription to Shudder or AMC Plus, it's available there as well.
Okay.
So check it out. Again, Mike, it's been great to have you here today. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it was a blast, man. I love coming. It's fun to talk about these things and, you know, be able to share it with the world.
Well, that does it for us. Happy movie watching.
Enjoy your movies, guys. Welcome to spooky season.
Peace out.
Peace out.
Peace out.